A warm welcome to this talk, and I'm delighted to welcome Mr. Julian Gillespie all the way from Sydney. Julian, welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Dr. Campbell.
Yep. Now, you're a former barrister, and you've been doing one heck of a lot of legal work and digging around over the past few years. And we're going to talk about that in some detail, but why should people watch this video? What is interesting about it and what is important about it?
It's the subject matter that's interested you enough to ask me to come onto your show. And we regard it as probably the best kept secret by government in the globally at this point, with respect to the particularly the mRNA vaccines, as they're called. Of course, we don't believe they're vaccines. In most jurisdictions globally, they actually fall under the legal definitions for being properly described as genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. And that's the little secret, which just about every government that rolled those particular drugs out has withheld from their populations. And that's what we've been in the courts dealing with here in Australia, and what we've exposed as relevant legislation affecting UK citizens, European Union citizens, and US citizens, as well as South African citizens. All of those countries have legislation which deem these products to be GMOs, but they didn't go through the proper regulatory processes, and so that little secret was withheld from populations who asked to receive these.
So the vaccines can actually, by legal definitions, are legally defined as genetically modified organisms. And that's got massive implications in Australia, the UK, the United States, everywhere. So absolutely vital. Just tell us, if you don't mind, Julian, what got you interested in this and what you've been doing for the past few years working on it.
Well, it all arose in 2021 when I heard politicians of all people, who aren't qualified medical practitioners in most instances, repeatedly calling upon these drugs as being safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. And I said, well, hold on a second. You keep saying they're novel and new drugs. How do you know they're safe and effective? But moreover, with a bit of science background, I understood that they were developed from the original Wuhan strain from early 2020. However, we were in 2021 and the SARS-CoV-2 virus had altered drastically over that period of time to be many variants into the future. And my first prickling was like, well, hold on, nobody walks into a doctor's surgery in 2021 and asks to receive the flu shot that was distributed in 2019. So I already knew that the 2021 version of these so-called vaccines was already way out of date, because the variants had, you know, propelled themselves into, you know, we were nearly into Delta just before Omicron. And it's like, well, why are asking people to take a vaccine for an old virus when we're up to many variants subsequent? And then there was just the discovery that this was an entirely new biologics platform that was being used in these drugs that had never been used before for any form of vaccination, let alone on a population scale. And this particular biologics technology or platform, the modRNA LNP complexes, had only been used in what's called a bespoke situation for persons who were essentially had run out of all options, had dire health issues, so they were looking deaf in the face, and they would go to specialists using these. Moderna was the one who was trying to do this before COVID, who would make very particular individualized injections for terminally ill patients. Very, very risky. Most of those patients, I knew from very quick research, subsequently died, a lot of them from complications. The risks of using this technology. And so there we had the Australian government and ministers without medical qualifications saying safe and effective. And so again, with that science background, we started scratching around, and I looked at the relevant Therapeutic Goods Act for the approval for these drugs in this country. And I realized that, well, hold on, the Therapeutic Goods Administration has invalidly approved these drugs. And we had a situation of essentially illegally approved drugs going out and into the community that needed to be challenged. So that resulted in us bringing first the AVN proceedings in the federal court against our Secretary of Health. That ended prematurely because the court used an unreal technicality to stop the proceedings moving forward. That was with respect to standing, the court saying we didn't have legal standing. So there we had walked into the court with this mountain of evidence weighing us down in one hand, showing unprecedented deaths and injuries in this country from the rollout of these drugs. We had more injuries and deaths from these COVID drugs in 2021 than in the preceding 50 years of all traditional vaccines in Australia. That's incredible. In 1 year, more deaths and more injuries from one type of drug than 50 years of prior vaccines. And so you talk about a safety signal. So we were there in the court saying, we've got all these people dying. We need to show the court that the decision approving them is legally challengeable, and the court should declare that, yes, these should never have been approved. And it was remarkable, John, because we had this weighty evidence, all from experts, doctors and statisticians, professionals, and yet the court wanted to have us all concentrate on this legal standing thing, saying legal standing's important, legal standing's important. And we're trying to say, well, no, it's actually not. The deaths and injuries we're talking about are the important thing. But this was this legal fiction, Alice in Wonderland, that we were garden path, we were taken down by the federal court. So we stopped those proceedings. And very quickly, there was an emerging new approval for babies of the same drugs. And the approval was being extended to Moderna. So we started what's called the Australian Babies case. This time we went to the High Court, the highest court in Australia. And the first thing we said to the High Court, listen, the federal court has got a bee in its bonnet about this legal standing issue. It wants to waste all of our time on legal standing, yet we're here with now a wheelbarrow of evidence with respect to deaths and injuries. And we are telling you, High Court, this is a situation of preventable deaths and injuries. Let's get rid of this legal standing fiction and look at the actual evidence. The High Court had the temerity to turn around and tell us, essentially, we don't think this is a good use of our resources. And so we're not going to listen to you. Go back to the federal court. And so we realized then that there was a fix on, as they say, that the federal court, and now with the assistance of the High Court, was protecting the Secretary of Health, because by this stage, millions of these doses had been rolled out into the community. So we're talking about massive legal liability area here, that were we to have what's called our day in court to present that wheelbarrow of evidence, then the court would have been in the corner of having to say, Secretary of Health, it does appear that you illegally approve these drugs illegally. And so we are going to rescind those approvals and no more of these drugs can go out into the community. Now, of course, if the court made that declaration and the rest of the Australian community heard it, they would have said, hold on, you've just been mandating and coercing us for the past over 12 months now to take these things at all costs. And you were telling us they're safe and effective. And now you're telling us that the court is sanction those approvals as illegal. So this is why, in my view and the view of many others, that the court has broken what's called the separation of powers doctrine here. It has gone out to protect the executive government. The executive government has oversight of the Department of Health. So that's a pretty steep curve to try and climb when the High Court's telling you to go away. During all that work, particularly the Australian Babies case, I had cause to return to what's called the Gene Technology Act. One of my colleagues in the background, who's highly credentialed in the sciences, I'll just put it in those terms so I don't identify the person, did suggest These things are gene therapies. They're gene therapies. And this person was well positioned to know, having all the right qualifications in that particular area of science. I'll just say that. And so I finally circled back to the Gene Technology Act. And it was a difficult read for me, even as a lawyer, because it was just so heavily science-laden. But I threw myself into it, and I emerged probably 3 or 4 weeks later, and I said to my legal colleagues, I said, hell, these are, in fact, not just gene therapies, they're genetically modified organisms. So then we worked with PhDs in molecular biology, going through the legal definitions of what determines a product to be a GMO in this country. And when we stepped through the legal definitions with the PhDs with the proper credentials, they sat back and they went, hell, you're right. These things are GMOs. They're very clearly and easily understood to be GMOs. What's gone wrong here? These things should have gone through not the TGA first. They were meant to go to the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator here in Australia and submit an application, quite simply, for a GMO license, a genetically modified organism license. Now, that might be startling and seem surreal and unreal to a lot of your viewers here today, but it's not. If people went and did a bit of inquiry, they'll find, for instance, in Australia, we all know AstraZeneca was a third product for this COVID SARS-CoV-2 thing. AstraZeneca did go to the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator in Australia and did apply for a GMO license, went through an extensive risk assessment and risk management plan process, and in the result, the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator gave AstraZeneca a GMO license. Now, with that license, then AstraZeneca could approach the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia and seek provisional approval of its COVID drug. If any doctors, Australian doctors out there, have any old products in the back of their fridge, if they go and look at the product insert or the product information contained within the AstraZeneca box, it will have very clearly written at the top, genetically modified organism. They did not mention that to the Australian public. It was not broadcast, even though the risk assessment process conducted by the, called the OGTR, Office of the Gene Technology Regulator, the risk assessment process did the proper thing and put it out to public consultation. And so when you look at that final determination by the OGTR, you will see this very extensive section where public submissions were received and considered by the OGTR before that GMO license was granted. Now, we can say in hindsight, 2020, that GMO license should never have been provided for AstraZeneca to proceed, because very shortly after the TGA approved the drug and it was deployed into the community, many people died of blood clots, and subsequently that drug was restricted to the use. I don't know why they came up with this figure, but for persons only 50 years and older. Anyway, that's a story. What we have with Pfizer and Moderna is almost exactly the same mechanism of action for fulfilling the legal definitions of what is a genetically modified organism in this country. And that is simply, it's really three criteria. It's very straightforward, and we'll probably get to it in your notes in a moment, John. But first of all, it has to be any, that word's very important, any biological entity, any. Because you've got that word any there in a legal definition, it means anything, any biological entity. The second portion is capable of transferring genetic material. You say, okay, well, what's the any biological entity? You've got the modRNA in both the Moderna and Pfizer products, so that my fist there is a clump of genetic material, the modRNA. Modified RNA. It's synthetic RNA. There's nothing natural about the RNA in either of those drug products.
Yeah.
And in the manufacture process, it's combined with LNPs, lipid nanoparticles. The lipid nanoparticles completely encapsulate the modRNA to protect it after it's injected, so it can travel through, biodistribute throughout the body, and it goes indeed to the brain, testes, ovaries, liver, hearts, lung, goes everywhere. So it safely gets it through the bloodstream, so it doesn't undergo attack and get disintegrated, and then it presents it to cells in all of those organs that I mentioned. The lipid nanoparticle has basically a chemistry affinity with the cell membrane of all cells within our bodies, right? The lipid nanoparticles is a type of fat that they both sort of share. That lipid nanoparticle envelope around the mRNA allows this whole complex to transfect or move across the cell membrane. So from out of the bloodstream to across the cell membrane and inside the cell. And once it's inside the cell, the lipid nanoparticle comes away and the modRNA is free to move with inside the cell in the cytoplasm. Now, let's just go back to that definition, capable of transferring genetic material. What I've just described there is the physical transportation of the modRNA LNP complex through the blood, comes to a cell, transfects across the membrane, delivers genetic cargo inside the cell. That's a capable of transferring. The transfer is just the physical transferring throughout the body and into the cells and into the cytoplasm. So we've met the second part of the definition. The third part is that genetic material was created by recombinant technology. That's not a biggie here, because both companies, in all of the applications globally, very, very clearly say our product contains modified nucleosides. Modified nucleosides. Now, you can only modify nucleosides using what's called recombinant technology. And that is the creation of synthetic modified RNA that is not natural. They create it wholly in the lab. That's the recombinant technology. So all three elements have been established in this country. It was established for AstraZeneca and Pfizer Moderna, met the same three, ticked off the same three boxes. But inexplicably, they didn't pound on the door of the OGTR and ask to submit an application for a GMO license back in 2020.
This is the Office for Gene Technology.
That's correct, like AstraZeneca did. Now, we've brought our third set of proceedings, is again in the federal court, and this time, instead of wasting any further time trying to challenge the Secretary of Health, we're going directly against Pfizer and Moderna for their failure to obtain those GMO licenses, because they've always required them, just like AstraZeneca. And indeed, in this country, to in any way dealing means manufacture or importing and or transporting and or storing and or disposing of a genetically modified organism. Any one of those types of dealings or altogether or a portion of them requires a GMO license. And so there's been this continuous stream, of course, of the product ever since it was released onto the market here in February of 2021 of those various forms of dealing. And none of them have been performed with anyone holding a GMO license. Now, if you deal with a GMO in this country without a GMO license, you're committing what's called at law a serious criminal offense. Now, as soon as you see serious in front of criminal offense in this country or any other Commonwealth common law country, that means it's a biggie. It's a very serious thing that they're doing here. Now, we've been in the Federal Court of Australia since last year, and part of the papers that we were returned, that you see various sorts of forms of discovery. We haven't had a lot of deep discovery at this point in time, but one of the documents produced by Pfizer evidences the fact that Pfizer did, in fact, go and knock on the door of the gene technology regulator here in Australia. Yes. Around about the third quarter of 2020. And for some reason, the gene technology regulator within the OGTR, then Dr. Raj Bula, who is still holding that position, said to Pfizer, you boys are all right. If you have any further information, come back to me. But at this point in time, just go straight to the TGA. Now, she had no legal basis to do that whatsoever. And ever since, we discovered these products are GMOs. She's been on the hop trying to cover her tracks, essentially. And her office has made overt, just public statements, almost, you know, press releases, which can't really be challenged. They're just, you know, it's her just throwing out her opinion. And on the public side with these press releases, she very boldly says, oh, these drugs, you know, never required GMO licenses. And it's like, well, hold on. We're in court challenging that directly, yet she's putting out these public statements, trying to get in front of public opinion. Yet, I think you've met before in our country, Senator Gerard Rennick. He's been one of our outstanding senators in the Commonwealth Parliament, who's been pushing back. Yeah, pushing back on these drugs for several years now, together with Malcolm Roberts, Ralph Babette, and a few others. Now, Gerard Rennick had the opportunity of requesting Dr. Raj Bhullar, as the gene technology regulator, appear before what's called a Senate Estimates Committee. That's where senators get to grill Commonwealth bureaucrats to see if they're actually doing their job for the money that that they're provided every single year. And they can ask any question that they want, really. It's quite the opportunity to cross-examine, like we see in court proceedings, but even with more license at times. Now, back on 26 October of last year, 2023, just before, we're talking about 10 minutes before midnight, before the whole day's proceedings had to come to an end, Gerard Rennick managed to get Dr. Bhullar into that chair and to undergo questions. Everyone was tired, and she finally slipped up. She finally slipped up, and she admitted, it's on video, it's on the Substack that we'll look at later, where she admitted that indeed these products involve a step in genetic modification in their manufacture. But then she boldly went on to say, oh, but that occurred overseas, and so we didn't have to regulate that. Okay. It's like, well, that was the way that she, it was a bit of sleight of hand. It's like, well, that's correct. Pfizer and Moderna wouldn't have needed to apply for a GMO license with respect to the manufacturing part of the dealing, because that was wholly offshore. But Raj, what about when they went to import those things and then transport them around the country and have them stored variously and then subsequently disposed? She didn't go on to talk about that aspect of her office being required to regulate Pfizer and Moderna, aka Moderna and Pfizer needed to come to her office and say, we're manufacturing overseas, you can't touch us, but we need to bring this stuff into the country, so we need a GMO license, please. She didn't go on to talk about that. That's where she's on the run, almost, in public relations terms, because all of those subsequent steps were undeniably her jurisdiction, the mandate of her office to oversee, govern, regulate, and to do so before Pfizer and Moderna could possibly approach the TGA for those provisional approvals, which finally released the products to the rest of the community. So unfortunately, that's the not short or not even long version of the backstory that you requested a few moments ago. But here we find ourselves now. And just to anticipate what we're going to discuss, what we discovered in Australia with these GMO laws, we said, heck, these are very, very sophisticated, very articulate, very refined GMO laws in this country under our Gene Technology Act. Where did the Australians get, you know, the knowledge to create this act back in 2000? That would have required, you know, the 1990s, a lot of thinking about creating our Gene Technology Act here. So we undertook legal research into South Africa, the United Kingdom, the European Union, Canada, and the US to see if there was anything else like our legislation there. And indeed there is, almost word for word, John, in South Africa, almost exactly the same legal definitions. We go into the United Kingdom, almost word for word, exactly the same legal definitions, same. All across the European Union, almost exactly the same legal definitions. Canada, unfortunately, has nothing. It's only, they only regulate GMOs and plants, but we found by a different route, the same GMO concerns also in the US. And so then we sat back and went, holy crap, all of those jurisdictions, except for Canada, knew all these things as well at the same time that these products were being deployed universally around the world. And we've got all this flouting of the law going on from one jurisdiction to another. This is what we're going to talk about further. And the ramifications of that are extraordinary, because we've heard so many times the issue of informed consent, that is providing patients with all the information necessary so they can perform that last moment risk-benefit assessment of whether or not they're going to receive something into their body. Now, we know there was plenty of failings on so many issues by doctors and health practitioners globally when it came to so much information with respect to these novel and never before used technologies. But one issue which resonates with a lot of people, no matter what sort of scientific background they've got, when you mention genetically modified organism, that strikes a bell for everyone. What? Hold on. Tell me more, doctor. What is this thing? A GMO? And this is exactly what we're trying to raise with these proceedings and this discussion, to say this isn't just isolated in Australia. This has occurred globally. And this is why so many politicians have been running from the issue, because they do not want to be seen as the late messenger for all of the world's patients who receive these things, to say, there's something your doctor didn't tell you. And sorry, your doctor didn't actually know, because your health regulator didn't tell them. But you've received a GMO, and that very well can have genetic consequences.
I mean, these gene technology acts around the world were put in place for very good reasons, in that genetically modified organisms can represent an existential threat, a threat to the existence of humanity, because the potential to engineer a genetically modified organism, which has got a very, very high infection fatality rate, very, very high transmissibility, that risk is there. So it's what came to my mind when you were talking there, Julian, is if I went to a shop and asked for a bag of apples, and the shopkeeper said, certainly, here's a bag of apples, he gave me a bag, and I got home and I found there were oranges. Well, I would be inconvenienced. I'd have to go back and say, yeah, just a minute, you know, you've given me oranges on it. But we're not talking about that. We are talking about governments around the world and regulators around the world that said, hey, John, here's a vaccine. And because I've given vaccines all my life and received vaccines all my life, I said, oh, vaccines. Oh, jolly good. But they weren't vaccines. They were genetically modified organisms. And not only that, they said they would stay local, they're systemically distributed. They said they would only transfect in the arm. They transfect systemically. You know, basically, I'm furious. And I think a lot of people are angry about this misrepresentation, much more serious than confusing apples and oranges. And what you've told me there, any biological entity, tick, I get that one, capable of transferring genetic material, the transfection is obvious, or it wouldn't work, tick. And recombinant technology, these are new organizations of the adenine, guanine, cytosine and uracil, the basis of the ribonucleic acid. I just find it totally convincing. And I'm just really quite, well, yeah, very angry that it's been misrepresented in this way. The other question that springs to my mind is that a lot of manufacturers around the world, certainly in the UK, Pfizer, Moderna, were given indemnity, inexplicably, by our politicians. Some people might have some ideas why our politicians exempted them from indemnity, but we don't know. I certainly don't know. Would the fact that these are genetically modified organisms and not vaccines as claimed invalidate that indemnity that manufacturers were awarded by our government?
It's an interesting legal argument for sure. And so, to be clear, we've currently got the civil proceedings against Pfizer and Moderna in the federal court, and what we're seeking there is to show the federal court that A, that they are GMOs, and that B, both manufacturers knew that they were GMOs and therefore should have applied for GMO licenses. Now, when we do that, those two boxes tick off, then show the court, well, that means both companies are committing a serious criminal offence. Once that's understood by the court and recognised, well, then the court should issue us an injunction preventing any further supply of those products. But let's just take it back a few steps there. We have to show the federal court in a civil context that therefore these companies are committing a serious criminal offence by not having the GMO licences. The court's not going to penalise those companies in any criminal respect. They're just going to issue us, hopefully, an injunction to stop them, because we don't want the supply anymore to the next unknowing family or the mother with their child who's not been informed about this. Now, the criminal aspect, that requires the prosecuting authorities. And so we've taken this material to our Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions and set it all out in a criminal brief of evidence for that authority, simply saying, well, we've got the evidence here. It satisfies the legal definitions. But moreover, this isn't really a contest anymore, because Dr. Raj Bueller, before a Senate Estimates Committee last year, admitted that they are GMOs. So with that admission that they are GMOs and the manufacturers not having the GMO licenses, we've got serious criminal offences. Please prosecute. So that's all been laid out. And we first approached the Attorney General, who wouldn't return our calls or reply to our correspondence, just went silent. Okay.
General wasn't concerned that Australian laws might have been broken by the sound of that.
Well, the Attorney General has stayed silent, just silent. So we can't say exactly, but we know that we've given the very intelligent Mark Dreyfus all of this information. He's of King's Counsel, used to be called Queen's Counsel until the passing of Elizabeth. And so he's a very, very intelligent law officer. And we dare say, and I'm allowed to take a stab in the dark, that he hasn't responded because the information is correct. Now, the very first thing that you would do, seeking to stop any undue alarm in the community, if we were wrong, the Attorney General should have turned around and bopped us on the head and said, look, mate, your information's incorrect. They're not GMOs for these reasons. And don't go out into the community and scaring people. Right? That's what you do as a responsible law officer if our information was incorrect. But instead, we have Attorney General Mark Dreyfus staying silent. Because this is a huge political liability football that we're talking about, the hottest potato globally that I've ever seen in my life or known of in history. So then we elevate it to the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, who's meant to be apolitical, who's not to be concerned about potential government liability. And instead, the response that we got from the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, after showing the director that the gene technology regulator has admitted their GMOs. I mean, what more do you need, director? Instead, sent the brief back to us, didn't say our information was incorrect. Instead said, it's not properly formatted for the purposes of submitting as evidence in a court. That was bluster for saying, we've got this thing called the Evidence Act. You've got the same thing in your country. Your evidence has not been structured or packaged correctly in the appropriate, you know, manner for presenting in court. Now, that gets sent back, but here's where you start getting a little bit angry with the director. He doesn't point out which part of our evidence has not been packaged correctly. In other words, he has to leave it up to us to work out what he wants to, you know, what the form that he wants to receive it in before he'll take it to court. So this is a director of public prosecution who is trying to waste time at this point. Well, they're clearly in the back room doing damage control, because they know that our team is A, in the Federal Court of Australia, presenting evidence, and so they can't be seen to interfere with that, because that would be obstructing the course of justice and everyone would lose their jobs and go to prison if they try and interfere with that. But they also know that we've been out in the public, Substack articles, and communicating with other groups globally, like lawyers in South Africa, contacting UK MPs, like Andrew Bridgen MP has received a legal advice for the UK situation, showing how your MHRA was aware all the time that these things were GMOs, but chose not to inform the UK citizenry. Your population was not told, even though the MHRA was aware. We provided similar information to what's called MEPs, members of the European Parliament in the European Union, to show them how the European laws very, very clearly captured these drugs, but when they were being processed by the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, similar to your MHRA, inexplicably, the section that needed to be filled out on GMOs is just blank. Just blank, John. No explanation. Moderna, I think, put an NA there, not applicable. It's like, well, on what basis is it not applicable? It was entirely applicable. But here's the issue. And we saw it with the example of AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca, it's the same for the UK and the same for the European Union. Before you, Pfizer, Moderna could go properly to the MHRA. So I'll put the UK to one side. We'll just look at Australia and the EU. Before they could properly receive approvals in both the EU, millions of people, what is it, 340 million people or thereabouts, 26 million people in Australia, before they could go TGA in Australia and get approval, getting a GMO license requires both manufacturers to provide extensive, what's called dossiers, with a risk profiling. What are the genetic and environmental, but really risks to humans from introducing this new form of genetically modified organism? And then, so that dossier has got to be received by a group like the OGTR in this country, and a similar subcommittee to the European Medicines Agency that deals with GMOs in products there. And that requires months of evaluation. And here's the critical part. In both jurisdictions, the OGTR and the EMA are required to announce it, advertise it to the public, and say, we are doing a risk assessment before approval of this genetically modified drug. We are receiving public submissions. Now, those public submissions generally come from, well, Joe Blow, the guy on the street, who's just got some basic knowledge, but generally a lot of PhDs pile in. If you are independent of government, who know the subject matter, and like we saw with AstraZeneca, I read the public submissions, and particularly the expert public, private expert public opinions, and they just were scathing. They were scathing. I said, are you joking? You really want to introduce this unknown genetics platform as a vaccine of all things? Well, first, it's not a vaccine because it's a genetically modified organism. And secondly, this has never been done before, and it requires years of extensive safety profiling, not least of which, and you've said it 100 times on your channel here, John, genotoxicity and carcinogenicity testing. Genotoxicity. What effects will these genetic materials have upon natural human DNA?
That would have to have been done for a genetically modified organism license.
It had to have been evaluated. And if there was an absence of that testing provided by the manufacturers when they provided that original dossier, like if you're the OGTR and you receive the dossier from Pfizer and you're going through it, and it's like, Pfizer, where's your genotoxicity test? You've got to show us that there's no impacts on human DNA here.
And human cancers.
That's right, and human cancers. And so if you're the OGTR, you'd hand the dossier back to Pfizer and say, go and run those tests first, because we can't do a proper risk assessment unless we see definitively that there is no risk of genetic integration, disturbing natural genes, or potentially being oncogenic or creating tumors, cancers, as you just mentioned. These are all the fundamental tests that the gates that they've got to go through as part of a risk assessment. And any public person providing submissions to that form of risk assessment would have picked that up in a flash if the OGTR dared to go to a public submission round in the absence of genotoxicity tests, for instance. And it would have been picked up by the public. And if the OGTR or the equivalent committee in the EMA tried to push through the approval in the absence of genotoxicity studies and carcinogenicity studies, the public would have picked up on it. So we would have had two issues. They tried to get these approvals through, they forced them through, and like they did, they got a lot of them approved towards the end of 2020 or early 2021. Had they gone through the GMO assessment path first, as they are required to at law in this country and in the EU and in the US, and we can talk about the US a bit different later, there's no way that in Australia, for instance, there's no way a GMO license would have issued until much later, if at all, much later into 2021. Then they could have gone to the TGA and sought provisional approval, meaning that Pfizer, for instance, may not have achieved ultimate approval for deploying physically their product until maybe 2022. And so by illegally cutting the GMO step out of the picture, they allowed them to advance quickly to the TGA and then get that much, much earlier approval without any of the public knowing about the GMO aspect, let alone the ability to comment and say, are you joking? So this was all about cutting the public out of the information loop. So I guess they would say, you're going to hear this one rolled out for sure, John. You'll get somebody in the TGA here and in Europe and also in the UK saying, oh, but we didn't want to create vaccine hesitancy. They're actually going to say that at some point, you know it. And then you've got to say, and sorry, respectfully, John, but if you get to hear a politician say that, you've got to say, shut up, mate, shut up, because they're not vaccines, but they're GMOs. And I'm allowed to have GMO hesitancy. I'm allowed to have GMO hesitancy when there's been no genotoxicity studies conducted, for instance, to inform me about whether or not this GMO is going to alter the natural DNA of my child and alter my ovaries or alter my sperm and thereafter for all of my progeny and offspring alter their DNA if indeed they make it to life.
Well, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have had hesitancy. I would have had abject terror and rejection, as I suspect the entire world's population would have done. It's just, we understand why people are angry.
It really is quite disastrous, and it's very saddening. And I have to use the expression in this country because it's just calling a spade a spade. Yeah. Our health authorities knew about this. They still deployed them. Multiple doses, and so that's multiple deliveries of synthetic genetic cargo, and they poisoned the DNA well, the natural DNA well of this country. Now, they're going to have the mendacity to come back and say, prove it. Right? They're going to be so arrogant and bold and desperate, they're going to say, prove it. Prove it that we've altered the DNA of the country. And everyone watching this has to, if they hear any politician or bureaucrat say that particular thing, prove it, say, mate, it was your job. You get paid the billions for your ministry every year to prove it's not going to affect us before you give it to us. Don't put the onus on me now that you've injected me multiple times to prove that something that you told me was safe and effective hasn't altered my genes. It was your job, always. And the legislation clearly says that, globally, that the regulator has.
And it's clearly a genetically modified organism from what you've said. I hadn't realised that before. It's quite powerful, really.
And let's just look at that issue of what types of, you know, genetic material are we speaking about here? With the standard product, we've got the LNP-modRNA complex, right? The two go together. You haven't got a product, the modRNA alone, if you just inject that, it gets destroyed in the bloodstream very quickly. It needs to be protected by the LNP.
It just be recognized as foreign material and immediately eradicated. Well, it's,
in science, they call it a complex. The two have to go together for the thing to work.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking about modified synthetic RNA here.
Yeah.
We've seen on websites, and they're still persisting with the lie in this country on the TGA's websites, that it doesn't enter the nucleus. Right. Well, A, that's wrong, because we provided the science papers to the Secretary of Health in this country. We did that in early 2022, showing studies that indeed this mod RNA does make its way into the nucleus of cells. When it produces the synthetic spike protein, the spike protein has a section in it that's called an NLS, a nuclear localization signal. Now, what that effectively is a portion of that protein, the spike protein, it's a key that gives it entry, grants it entry to go into the nucleus, to open the nuclear envelope. And there's this other aspect of the spike protein. It has an affinity with the actual modRNA which creates it to passage it, give it a ride, in other words, to take the modRNA into the nucleus as well. Now, the science papers are there showing this. We've got the Alden paper, we've got the Quinn paper, we've got several, and they're in the in all the links that will be shared in the show notes later. So we've backed everything. And so we went to the TGA when we were suing the Secretary of Health, and we said, look, We can still fight this thing out in court, but stop putting this persistent lie on your website that it doesn't go into the nucleus. It does. We've given you the material. We did this by a private and direct note appealing to the Secretary of Health. Stop the rubbish communications. Okay. Again, he had the arrogance not to respond. He didn't refute. He just didn't respond. Now, we were just doing the proper sciencey thing here. It's like, here's the information, and he doesn't do us pay us the respect to come back and say your science is wrong. He just stayed silent. We had him, okay, but he persists with this lie. Now, so let's just take it for granted, and can be found in all the links later on, that it does go into the nucleus. Mod RNA. So we're talking about RNA. RNA, DNA, RNA, DNA, different things. Exactly, sure, but there's this thing called reverse transcription. Reverse transcription, and that's what the Alden paper shows with the Pfizer product, that it reverse transcribes into DNA. And there's a type of enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which is part of what's called line dash one, which is found in all cells. It's found in more cells that are undergoing rapid cell division. So you'll find that around the ovaries, for instance, or a newborn, the embryo, because they're rapidly dividing. So there's lots of line one activity there. Therefore, there's lots of reverse transcriptase. Reverse transcriptase is a way of, to put it in pretty straightforward terms, read the RNA and say, okay, I can convert you into DNA. Now, just as DNA gets read and converted into RNA, which goes off and creates proteins, it's just the reversal, effectively, of the same process. But this, on this occasion, the enzyme reads the RNA first and translates it, transcribes it, and translates it into DNA, slips it into the DNA. The science on this is called retroposition. Mm-hmm. Retroposition. Now, all these statements since 2021 that this stuff cannot interfere with DNA is based on absolutely no science, because they never performed those studies that we spoke about, John. But what all the health regulatory bodies have known for, I think it's going on nearly 50 years now, is the science of retroposition. That is how RNA gets reverse transcribed into DNA. Indeed, there was a Nobel Prize awarded on the science in this area. It is so highly understood. But yet when the modRNA drugs came out, they denied the science even existed.
I've known about it personally since the 80s from the AIDS pandemic.
There you go. Right. Well, yes, of course, because that's part of the mode of action there.
Yeah.
I wrote a paper which was subsequently peer reviewed and published called The Canaries in the Human DNA Mind, which speaks to the Australian and European GMO laws and makes it very clear that they apply, but also goes into the very well established science on retropositions. And one particular paper which brought this to everyone's, or sought to bring this to everyone's attention in 2021, which was titled, "What About the Science of Retropositions?" You know, this fellow was, this PhD was saying, this science has been around for 50 years, but we've got all the regulatory agencies saying that there's no chance of reverse transcription. And he was very politely saying, they're all lying to you. All of these regulatory agencies are lying to you. So we've got that. The main constituents, ingredients of Moderna and Pfizer is, you know, receiving trillions of particles of this modified RNA. Hundreds of billions, if not trillions, but it's in that range per dose.
Yeah, pretty sure it's trillions, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, your chances then, after you've taken a second, a third, and fourth, you know, boosters and all the rest of it, are just compounding as to respect to the probability of reverse transcription occurring. And therefore, your DNA has been changed. And therefore, something's going to occur with your DNA. It's either wherever it gets integrated, the genes in that area are either going to be upregulated, in other words, they're going to express more of something that they shouldn't be expressing, or under-express, or silenced. Now, whenever you do that, you're completely blowing the rhythm, if you like, of the way that those genes should be normally functioning. And when you disturb the equilibrium, well, then you're heading down all sorts of paths to what we call generally genetic disease. And that's, I mean, just throw a dart at the board on that one.
And well, cancer's a genetic disease.
And then we ultimately end up with disturb the genome sufficiently, and the cell just says, let's just go cancer. That's what the cell does. Like, look, this is a mess. The DNA is not working. Let's just go to cancer mode. That's what cells sort of essentially do.
Yes, it's multiple mutations, essentially. Yeah.
That's right. So we're in that territory, and we know, despite health authorities and governments paying off mainstream media to shut up about turbo cancers and the rise of turbo cancers. Look, Professor Dalgliesh has been on several times. God, how many credentials do you need until you listen to a man with that authority, with that expertise? How long can MP say he doesn't know what he's talking about? I mean, it's absolutely despicable and disgusting, the contempt that this man who's alerting everyone as to what's going on is just being shuttered, right? And he's not the only one. They're everywhere, these specialists around the globe who are saying it's real, the phenomenon's real. And it's not just the cancers. It's all the other spectrum of diseases and disorders that we've seen arising out of the adverse event reporting systems globally, okay? They run into the thousands of different conditions. Thousands of different conditions. And you say, well, how can just some LMP and modRNA create that variety of adverse events? It's like, well, buddy, this stuff isn't just going into the cytoplasm. It's going into the nucleus and disrupting the activity of DNA, the blueprint for life.
And all over the body as well.
That's right.
Systemic distribution.
This stuff won't be just integrating in just one specific site in our chromosomes for every person. It will be doing it in many, many different areas. And so if it's disrupting different segments, different sequences, a multitude of different sequences of DNA, well, then you're going to get a multitude and variety of genetic disorders or diseases, right? They won't be identified immediately as having a genetic disease origin, but they'll have a multitude of disease. when we start to underlearn the new pathways of where these diseases are originating from, with more discrete studies and analysis, the scientists in the lab are going to go, oh, hell, that disease is normally originates in, you know, that part of our physiology, but this is tracking back to actually DNA dysfunction, right? So a lot of this stuff's going to in due course. That's what we anticipate. And I'm not just talking as, I'm not conjecturing here. A lot of our team work with a lot of PhDs and professors and associate professors of medicine, and we have these discussions. These are the people who know and who share their ideas with me so I can share them with you. So we've spoken about the modRNA. That's one aspect of it. But correct me if I'm wrong, have you not spoken with Kevin McKernan in the past, the geneticist?
No, I haven't, no.
Oh, okay. I thought you had presented to your viewers the DNA contamination that's been discovered.
Oh, we've talked about DNA contamination, but not Kevin McKernan.
Okay, well, it was Kevin McKernan who was the one who raised the flag first.
Right.
And
right,
what an appropriate individual to do it. I had been waiting.
Yeah, the DNA contamination in the simian virus.
That's right. So Kevin came out with that in February of last year. Now, I knew of Kevin beforehand, and I'd been watching him, I guess, from the sidelines, so to say, throughout 2021 and 2022, wondering if he was ever going to make any investigation with respect to these drugs, because he was the lead researcher on the Human Genome Project. And that was a very sophisticated exercise, the mapping of the human genome. And I've got some intimate knowledge about that because my brother, who's an associate professor in genetic epidemiology, was a member of the Human Genome Project. And so it's been in our family for decades now. Now, Kevin McKernan finally received, well, he came into some vials of both Pfizer and Moderna. And, you know, there's a backstory there. But he's the guy, if you want to go to anyone and say, what's in this substance? He's the guy who knows all the tests because he developed all the mapping tests for determining what a particular substance might be made up of. And so he received Pfizer and Moderna vaccines and he ran them through his sequencing PCR, qPCR initially, and put out his preliminary findings in February of last year and said, whoa, everybody, hold on. Our first results are these things are not just a little contaminated with synthetic DNA, they are grossly contaminated. And words had to be used like excessively contaminated. Now, one of the measures from the early series of tests, because it took him quite a few attempts to nail down, quantify. You know, when you've got new chemicals, which is what these are, they're regarded as a new biological entity. You have to match certain what's called primers to be able to properly locate, you know, DNA, for instance, in these vials amongst all the LNP material, amongst all the modRNA. In other words, separate all that stuff out and say, okay, what's left? Is that DNA and how much of that DNA is there? And so he went through a series of tests and then speaking with various colleagues. We got to figures like, just to be clear, a little backstory, modRNA requires plasmid DNA to create that modRNA.
That's from a bacteria that the RNA
is synthesized in. Yeah. And when the modRNA is created, it's all in one big vat. They're meant to put in these what's called DNAs. The DNAs is essentially a detergent which it's not meant to affect the modRNA, but it'll break up all the DNA that created
from the cells that produce the RNA, the E. coli cells.
And then that broken down DNA is then meant to be filtered away, separated.
Yep.
So then you've just got the modRNA, which then they combine with the LNP. But with any manufacturing process, there's always the risk of a little bit of, let's say, residual product from the manufacturing process. And that's been known for decades now, that for that particular technique, creating synthetic RNA from from synthetic DNA. That's been going on for decades. So just to be clear to all your viewers. And it's been recognized for decades that sometimes the final product will have a little bit.
Tiny bit.
A very tiny bit of that broken up DNA, and it's called residual template or residual DNA template. Now, the FDA, and it's the same guidelines that have basically been followed globally, TGA follows the same thing, has recognized for several decades that no more than 10 nanograms of residual DNA template should be present in any one particular dose. That's a very, very small,
nanograms,
very, very small amount. What Kevin McKernan discovered was that that limit of 10 nanograms has been exceeded by as much as 509 times greater. So we're talking about literally thousands of times above the legal limit. And here's where the scary part is. That 10 nanogram limit per dose was in respect of what was recognized and always understood as naked DNA. Naked DNA. So that is to say, there's just a little fragment of DNA all by itself floating in the syringe that goes into you. Naked DNA, when it hits the bloodstream, a little fragment of or something else, your immune system just recognizes, it's called exogenous. Like, oh, there's some foreign, there's a fragment of foreign DNA. I'm just going to go and scoop that up. That's rubbish, right? We always get foreign DNA in us from just our surrounding environment, the food we eat, everything. And the body's just used to picking it up like trash, like it does pick up so many other things.
Yeah.
But in this instance, and Kevin McKernan and his crew, his lab crew, were able to go and subsequently verify this. Just like the modRNA subsequently in the processing, manufacturing process, gets enveloped, encapsulated in the LMPs, these fragments of DNA are also being protected by the LMPs as well. And so, pardon me, that's a cloaking mechanism.
Yeah.
That's a cloaking mechanism. Okay.
So the DNA actually gets surrounded in its own lipid nanoparticles. So it's fully protected.
That's right. It's fully
protected through the bloodstream. The nanoparticles will take it through the cell membranes.
You just laid it out for us, John. And so it's given the passport. It's given the free passage to
free
buy
pass.
A go to the testes, go to the ovaries, go to the spleen, lungs, liver, and brain. Present to the cells in any one of those organs and then transfect into the cell. Now, let's be clear. When I use this example, you see me talking about one lipid nanoparticle complex. Now, the other science that they didn't tell you about these things is that the lipid nanoparticles, the LMPs, they tend to move as a group. It's all to do with their static charge, their electric charge. Okay. And so if somebody's the static charge on the actual cluster.
Cohesive effect, I think it's called.
That's right. It's got to do with zeta potential, these other terms.
Yeah.
But depending on one individual to the next, you can very well expect that because of this static charge, there might be a pull, like a lot of the LMPs will be pulled. Let's be properly graphic here. Pulled to my testes, right? There'll be a whole bunch of these LMPs, and we're talking in the billions.
Yeah.
Tens of billions or hundreds of billions. And so we'll get a whole bunch of these LMPs in the billions, perhaps in my testes, presenting to the cells there and then delivering not only the modRNA, but also significant quantities of the synthetic DNA. Okay, this is where my spermatozoa is created. That's meant to create my offspring. Now, this DNA is being delivered as efficiently, it's called efficient transfection. Like how well do we get this stuff into the cells? Well, it gets delivered very efficiently.
Aren't we clever?
Now, we spoke about the ability of the modRNA to be reverse transcribed into DNA. It's a completely simplified matter when it comes to the DNA. Now, a lot of this DNA fragment, particularly the Pfizer, because it's got the SV40 enhancer and promoter sequence, not the entire SV40 genetic sequence, which was found to have poisoned the polio vaccines of the 1960s and created decades of cancers afterwards. But just the SV40 enhancer and promoter, that's been used by scientists for a long time because it's super, super efficient at gaining entry into the nucleus of the cell. The enhancer has got, like I mentioned with the spike protein before, it's got a nuclear localization signal, but much, much more efficient. Much more efficient.
Straight into the nucleus of the cell.
Oh, yeah. It's like the nucleus is there going, good to see you back. Doesn't recognize that it's exogenous or foreign or synthetic. It's just like, oh, DNA, come on in. Like the nucleus is like, come on in. Come on. And now even in the absence of the SV40 enhancer, dividing cells open the nuclear membrane for a period of time before and then close before they divide. While that nuclear membrane's open, any other fragments of DNA that don't have, for instance, the SV40 enhancer, as soon as the membrane opens, that part, the nucleus, while it's open, goes, oh, look, some other DNA, quick, come in before we close. Come in before we close. Like, it's just, DNA is like a magnet to DNA. It just, they like to hang out. Right? They just like to hang out. So the efficiency, in other words, of this even fragmented DNA to gain access into the nucleus is just off the charts. It's off the charts. And there's very proper and very clear calculations on this. Indeed, one of the molecular PhDs who we've been working with, who's written the expert report for our GMO proceedings against Pfizer and Moderna and provided supporting expert evidence for the purposes of the criminal prosecutions with the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, has been able to show the established scientific literature that we're talking about up to 10 to up to 20% integration. So it's already understood that this stuff's going straight into the nucleus, but once it's in there, what's the next thing? The next part of the conversation, obviously, is what's it doing to the DNA, our natural chromosomes? By recent studies, up to 10 to 20% of what gets into the nucleus is being integrated. Integrated.
Becomes part of the genome of that cell.
That's right. And so that's a integration of synthetic DNA into our natural chromosomal DNA. Now, to be clear, chromosomal DNA is always undergoing changes, and that's natural. That's how we adapt to what the body says we need to change to adapt to ward off these new threats and these new threats. Okay, that's called mutagenesis. It's been going on forever in all species. It's a natural part of evolution. But when, on the other hand, you introduce a foreign, let alone a synthetic DNA, and it integrates into our genome, not via any natural process whatsoever, that's called transgenesis. Transgenesis. And that's what our chromosomes aren't ready for. But they're ready to undergo natural mutations because that's the natural cycle of things. But when our DNA is, they don't even know, our DNA doesn't even know that it's been force-fed, effectively, a synthetic DNA. And then it's in there, it's like, oh, hold on. You're upsetting the apple cart, mate. This new one's upsetting the apple cart. But it's too late. Once it's integrated, it's integrated. It's not like our chromosomes can say, oh, get out of here. No, man, you're upsetting the operations. Once it's in, it's locked in. So with a 10 to 20% integration rate, and then you take multiple shots of this stuff, well, then your integration rate just compounds, doesn't it? I mean, can we just look at the maths there? They did that off just studies of single applications or whatever they were working out that integration rate, Rib. But we're talking about multiple doses of this stuff, which was so aggressively pushed on nations everywhere under fear of, you know, you can't go and see granny, you can't go to your job, you know, all the oppression.
Well, you might kill granny if you don't get it.
Yeah. But, you know, here we are. We've got this situation where extraordinary contamination. The contamination wasn't just confirmed by Kevin McKernan. Let's be very clear about that. He was the first one to do it. Then another PhD out of the US, which was Buchholz. He sort of threw down the gloves, says, oh, I don't believe this, and went into his lab and then walked out just aghast. It's like, holy crap, it's actually worse than Kevin initially said, because he identified that that step of the DNAs where it seeks to fragment the plasmid DNA into little pieces is actually really efficient. And so we've got multiple, instead of one big plasmid contained circular DNA, it's broken up into multiple pieces.
Yeah.
And Buchholz said, you've just increased your chances of integration because there are multiple fragments of DNA now. And so if you throw multiple fragments at any one particular cell, you're going to exponentially increase the chances of an integration event. And so he's freaking out to the point now that he's conducting various studies of people who become seriously ill after taking these drugs to ascertain by taking various biopsies around, you know, from people's bodies, if he can identify integration events as having been the cause of these people's illnesses. It's a very proper and sensible pathway to go down. Now, Buchholz is not the only one. Koenig in Canada confirmed the same DNA contamination and levels of DNA contamination. The Dutch also did the same thing, and McKernan got hold of their data and was able to verify their data. In Japan, I know the people who smuggled out vials from Japan and got them over into US labs, and they've confirmed the same levels of contamination. And then there's David Speicher, who together with Kevin McKernan and Jessica Rose sampled, 27 vials up in Canada. And across all of those vials, we've got the same contamination. And where it's worse is that in early, Kevin raised, you know, sent up the flare in February of 2023 and made it very public. Like, Pfizer and Moderna know exactly who Kevin McKernan is because he was such a leader on the Human Genome Project. They
Francis Collins was as well. I don't know. He's got
that's right. Well, he was the boss. He was the boss of the Human Genome Project. And indeed, Pfizer and Moderna, they use instruments that were created by essentially the work of Kevin McKernan when it comes to DNA sequencing and RNA sequencing and so on. So when Kevin puts up a signal flare, they saw it, but they can continue to create their new bivalent vaccines, new bivalents. Kevin and David Speicher and Jessica Rose, Dr. Jessica Rose, tested the very latest versions, including the bivalent, and they were found to be more contaminated. In other words, he's given them a heads up, and they 9 months later, with the latest product coming off the manufacturing line, they didn't go and fix their manufacturing to get rid of this contamination or even try and reduce it. The product coming out worse, more adulterated.
Of course, in the original trials, the Pfizer trials, for example, the vaccine, in inverted commas, that was used was produced by a completely different manufacturing process.
Oh, yeah, the bait and switch.
The vast majority, I mean, we talked about this with Josh Getzko.
Yes.
In the trials originally, it was basically a PCR type method to make it.
That's right.
The vast majority of the vaccine used in the trials was this method, and then for the manufacturing, they use a completely different method with the DNA contamination. It's just
they're allowed to get
away with that.
Yeah, the process one, which was
process was one, not and process made, two. Yeah.
Yeah, which was not made with plasmid DNA.
With bacteria,
It was they directly through in vitro transcription created immediately the modRNA without any DNA as a step. And so that was a very clean product. And they gave that to 46,000 people, or there was a control, 22,000 received it and 22,000 was the control.
And we now know we also talked to a researcher in the States, I just can't remember his name now, I can see his face, who found out about 1 in 800 people had side effects.
Oh, that's Freeman. Ed Freeman.
Ed Freeman.
And he used to be part of one of the major journals. He used to be a former.
That's right. Very thorough piece of work.
Reanalysis of the Pfizer and Moderna data and found 1,800 people suffering adverse events. Back in the day, you couldn't get anything through a trial if it had a higher number than one and say 100,000. Yeah. Anything lower, well, then that was immediately black boxed, as Peter McCulloch would say. Yeah. And if there was any deaths to follow, then the product had to be pulled. Well, Dr. Jayanthi, part of the Daily Clout crew working with Dr. Naomi Wolf and Amy Kelly, they found those additional deaths, which were not included by Pfizer, even though the deaths occurred before the reporting cutoff date. So Pfizer mucked around with all their data, and had they been clean with their data, well, the product would never have been approved. But as you mentioned, they created the theatre of process one, everyone receiving this clean product, which still created enormous numbers of adverse events and deaths. And then at the last moment, they said, oh, but if we're going to deploy this on a population or indeed global basis, we need to use a different upscale manufacturing process for the volumes involved. That's process two. We'll test that, but we'll only test it on 250 people.
That's right, yeah.
And the EMA, the TGA here, the FDA, they're all playing this theater in this application process, saying, oh, look at these numbers, and this is for process one, the dummy. And in the footnotes on all those applications, they go, oh, but the manufacturer wants to switch to this process. It's only been tested on 250. They just have to give us follow-up data. They're approved. When the EMA, TGA didn't bother doing this, but when the EMA subsequently knocked on Pfizer's door and said, can you give us the follow-up data on the testing of that, the real process two stuff, the stuff that everyone's received? On those 250 people, Pfizer had the temerity to turn around and go, it's not relevant now. You guys have rolled it out to billions of people. It doesn't matter what our results say. Like, so arrogant. And the EMA said, okay, let's just keep walking. Let's just keep walking. And so the cover-up is on both sides.
Yeah.
Completely, completely irresponsible regulators on all of these issues. And it's all about, if no one knows, then we'll be okay, and we can keep our nearly $1 million a year positions as the head of the TGA or the MHRA or the EMA. But the cat's out of the bag. This is what these proceedings are all about. Mm-hmm.
I think we've been going for about an hour and 17 minutes now, so I think we're probably better wind it up there. I have got one question I'm curious about, though. Go on.
I have to answer your question. You said the indemnities provided to the manufacturer. Okay. The indemnities we've outlined to the Director of Public Prosecutions, we believe that they can be taken away in Australia because of all of this false information coming from the manufacturers and their failure to alert us about, for instance, the DNA contamination, which was easily discoverable, and we believe they've always known.
Yeah.
Now, that's a legal argument. Can these indemnities go away or not? Irrespective of the indemnities against the manufacturers, the government departments are liable anyway. Okay. Now, let's be clear. An indemnity means you can still sue Pfizer and Moderna. And if you win, it just means the government's got to pay. That's the only issue, right? They're not blocked from being sued. It's just who ultimately pays. But if you're going to be suing Pfizer and Moderna about this DNA contamination or the fact that these are GMOs and they weren't declared, you also will be suing your own government ministries, like the TGA in this country, the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator in your country, it will be the MHRA. And so don't be scared to sue these people. There's plenty of proper target defendants to go after, particularly because they all knew about this. So
this could apply retrospectively.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's often the case that people who are injured from medical products, it's because of something that occurred in the past.
Yeah.
And the courts fairly and squarely recognise that, and it's only subsequently that this knowledge is made known and understood by injured parties, and then they go, oh crap, wish I knew that back then, but I didn't, I got injured, now I want to sue those who led me down this path.
And would action be taken against individual officers within those departments, or do they enjoy some sort of vicarious liability?
Definitely. We've been seeking to raise a national class action lawsuit in this country, a proper one. There is one that is underway, but it's very, very narrow, and it doesn't list the range, the complete range of defendants who are all responsible.
And but if it's individuals, you can see why they're running scared and trying to cover this up.
Of course. Well, it's more than that, because it's not just suing a department and saying, oh, this office holder was responsible for the decision. In those circumstances, that's sort of suing the government, that department ends up paying when you can show liability. On this occasion, because, and it happened all across the world, because those individuals were out there spruiking marketing effectively on behalf of Pfizer and Moderna, that these things were safe and effective, you get to sue that public officer in their personal capacity. That means if liability is shown, in other words, they knew that those statements were false when they were making them to the public, the liability is in the individual, not as the Secretary of Health, it is as Brendan Murphy or whoever the relevant health minister was in your country during 2021. And that means the bill for that liability is meant to be paid out of the estate of the individual. In other words, the ministry isn't meant to pay it for them. So it's got enormous consequences for teaching these people the right lessons. It's like, no, you don't get to get the government purse to pay for your wrongdoing. This is going to involve you having to sell your house, mate, because you intentionally lied to millions of your fellow countrymen. Why did you do it? Because they were getting back-end payments somewhere. They must have been. You don't willingly send people off to slaughter like that unless you've been handsomely rewarded. These things will come out, you know, sometime down the road.
The Ministry of Health in my country at that time was called Matt Hancock.
Yeah, what? Yeah, we know about Hancock and his
He's
WhatsApp.
He's quite famous for being caught snogging his girlfriend in the in a cupboard somewhere or something when he was supposed to be socially distancing.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, well, nothing applied to Matt. And we saw that in his WhatsApp messages, didn't we? It was all about scaring the public. Yes.
Yeah. Just one last question, Julian. I get asked this all the time. Why on earth did governments around the world go for this ludicrously new genetic product rather than a tried and tested antigenic vaccine?
Yeah, well, see, that's I've been trying to work that out for quite some time because
so have I. There's something weird going on here, isn't
there? Yeah, there is a lot. And I had a long discussion with a Dr. Lisa Johnson on the weekend. She also contributed for our COVID-19 Royal Commission terms of reference, proposed references. And she's very, very knowledgeable in the area of transhumanism. And I was reading four manuscripts that she's getting ready to publish in that area. And the decades of industrial military research and money that's been going into transhumanism dating back into, indeed, the 60s. So Peter McCulloch, in one of his lectures, points out that this wasn't new. DARPA, through its ADEPT project, 10 years prior to 2020, had already put it up on their board saying, we are going to develop modRNA products which can be rolled out super quick within 1 year as a medical countermeasure, right? So there was nothing new about it. They always knew about this sort of technology platform, but they weren't able to safely deploy it. Well, they did on this occasion because they had politicians spruiking it as safe, even though it was anything but. So there's been a lot of pre-planning going back decades, and it appears to be a military-industrial complex thing, I'll just say thing, to get people to take this new technology platform. Now, we all know about the Wuhan lab, and Zheng Li was called the Bat Lady, okay? Mm. She was one of the chief scientists. Now, I don't think she's the bad person, everybody. I think she's just a straight-up scientist who was doing jobs commanded of her. You know, she was communist China, for Christ's sake. She gets orders, not suggestions. But she and her team actually identified very, very clearly SARS-CoV-2 virus in February of 2020 and released a paper published in March. yes, in March of 2020, saying, yep, we've seen it. This isn't really a big deal virus. And all it requires is a very, very safe, and indeed it was safe, nasal spray with this such and such protein in it. And I did the research on this protein for this nasal spray, and super harmless to humans. You know, we're talking about ivermectin safety type stuff. This compound's been around for decades and decades. And her team said, look, the world's got nothing to fear. They just need to take, you know, a pump of this maybe once or twice a day. It can be used as a preventative and also an early treatment. And no one has anything to worry about. Okay, there's no threat. That paper was buried. That paper was buried. And then you get other people like Pierre Corey, without the benefit of that paper, and Peter McCulloch come out and say, we're juggling, we're thinking hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin in different combinations. Yep. And I was there in 2020 hearing their messages, but that was beaten down, horse paced. We know the controversy. It was shot down. It was shot down in our country as well. TGA essentially outlawed.
And still is being.
Yes, yes. And so there was just this, by all costs, it must be these drugs and nothing else. So there was this determination. This wasn't just for profiting. Like, we know that Bill Gates, for instance, invested $55 million and made something like, you know, $1.5 billion in the result.
Pretty shrewd investor.
Yes. Well, he was invited in late 2019 to purchase an incredible quantity of Moderna shares. Very good.
Our prime minister was in a trust fund in 2013.
Yes. Yes.
We bought $500 million worth, $500 million worth of Moderna. Very far-sighted investor, it must be said.
Well, yeah, I'll call a spade a spade. He got an inside tip. It's called insider trading. But my point is, when you look at characters like Bill Gates, he didn't need the money whatsoever. Absolutely no. Didn't need the money. And it's like he was there behind the marketing push to get all these regulators to just kill off ivermectin, kill off hydroxychloroquine. We've got to have the populations take this stuff. Not for money. They've just got to take this stuff. What's the reasoning? Hey, we've just opened up a pretty disgusting chest of secrets here today. They knew about the reverse transcription. They knew about the DNA contamination. They knew these things. We can show this, John. They knew about it. They wanted these genetic unnecessary materials into people. As Kevin McKernan was saying in a Twitter conversation, somebody observed, it's like, well, why didn't they just, instead of DNA and modRNA, why didn't they just make the spike protein itself? Why didn't
as they did in China? No one in China's had an mRNA vaccine.
That's right. They didn't. Why did people get injected with modRNA when they only needed to give us the final product, the actual spike protein encapsulated?
Why did the Chinese government have sufficient insight to import, as far as I know, zero doses of mRNA vaccine use their own antigen vaccine?
Kevin McKernan went one step further and he said, yeah, the population only perhaps needed spike protein, but it didn't even need to be wrapped in a lipid nanoparticle and biodistributed. It only needed to be in a nasal spray in terms of delivery mechanism. Okay. And when you talk about the Chinese, hey, the Chinese got this whole theater going with all their fall over people videos that scared the world in early 2020. And we subsequently found out that they were all staged. They were actors. And the Chinese government didn't step in once to say, oh, no, these are just actors. They're just trying to scare you. They didn't go and do that. They helped proliferate those videos. And then, as you point out, they said no to the solution that was given to the Western world. So this was something that was geared with Chinese. And so I'd have my further view saying, look, China's the biggest creditor in the world. It can't afford to crash the market with its US bonds, but it can go to its biggest debtor and say, help us slip some genetic material into your population because we want to see what happens, and we also want to kill some of you. Because that's what's happened, John. We've had untold millions of deaths because of this product rollout of these modRNA products, as well as the AstraZeneca, which is a different mode of action. Undeniable millions of deaths and undeniable countless further millions of injured people. And now we've got the looming frontier of what's this genetic integration going to do. And just to be clear, yes, we do get the genetic diseases sort of immediately, and they'll be continue to unravel because these things don't immediately trigger disease. They take a while for genetic diseases to get up steam, and sometimes it takes 3 to 5 years for the final manifestation in terms of disease and illness to be seen in individuals. But when it comes to germline integration with ovaries and testes, you see that in the next proper full-blown generations, those that make it to term, indeed, because this stuff really does pose a jeopardy to, you know, the ability to sustain life anyway. But that's the next round that geneticists who are looking at the same material that we are saying, look, that's where we're going to see some massive impact. And what we are now responsible for doing is when we see, assuming we do see that genetic impact manifested in the next generations, we have to keep everyone's memory clear and say, this isn't just spontaneous. It goes back to something that occurred in 2021 when billions of people were asked to take these things or forced to.
Julian, we're going to put links to your sites, your publications underneath this. There'll also be a donation site for legal expenses in the UK. And I know you've been working flat out, and that's an understatement, for about 3 years now without getting paid for this. So, I mean, your service to the Australian people and the people of the world is truly impressive. And thank you for doing that.
But these are the rewards, is to share the critical information with persons like yourself, because my work means nothing unless it's shared and understood. And you're such a fine educator, Dr. John Campbell, it's this is payment.
Well, let's hope it gets out there. We might need to put this out in bits. We'll have to see. there's been, shall we say, I've had recent distribution difficulties, shall we say.
Yes, I think I understand.
With some recent videos, but the attempt will be a noble one.
Okay.
And there's more we need to talk about, Julian, but for now, thank you very much. It's good evening from me, and it's good morning from you.
Good morning from me, and good evening to you there.
And we'll talk again soon, and thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.